Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Wednesday, June 12th. I'm Lauren Schmidt, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, information sought on reported attempted kidnapping in Fortuna. Historic Soham Fire Training unites firefighters and cultural practitioners. And California makes progress towards conserving 30% of land and water. Stay tuned, news on those stories and more coming right up. The Fortuna Police Department is asking for the public's assistance in seeking information about a reported attempted kidnapping that occurred on the 2000 block of Redwood Way in Fortuna, behind the Safeway, involving two juvenile females.
This is Officer Taylor at Fortuna Police Department, and we, on Tuesday, June 11th of 2024, at approximately 1:25 p.m., received a report of an attempted kidnapping that had just occurred in the 2000 block of Redwood Way here in the city of Fortuna. There was two female juveniles reported walking in the 2000 block of Redwood Way when an unknown subject had driven up to them and asked them to get into the vehicle. The two juveniles refused to get in the vehicle, and as they attempted to walk away, the subject then kind of went up on the curb in possible attempts to block them from continuing to walk, in which then exited his vehicle and chased them for approximately 50 yards. The two juvenile females were able to run back towards the business of Safeway and contact their mother, who then contacted the police department. At that time, we had a description of the vehicle to be a older brown, light tan is what later determined, light tan, older extra cab vehicle. The male was described to possibly be in his 60s to mid late 60s, longer gray hair, kind of a narrow face, about 5'8", and wearing a green shirt and tan cargo pants.
On social media, images began to circulate of the vehicle that some members of the public believed to have been involved.
Today, we were able to locate that vehicle, and I was able to confirm that it was not involved. We did do an update on that. At this time, I mean, it's an ongoing investigation. We'll be transparent with the community and with updates. I don't think that the public needs to panic at this time. I think this was just a random act, and we're not certain at this point that what the intent of the suspects was. So, and obviously, if anybody has any information, it'd be greatly appreciated if they could contact the Fortuna Police Department at 707-725-7550.
Notably, on Tuesday in Mendocino County, a 10-year-old juvenile male reported to the police that he had been the target of an attempted kidnapping. However, after an investigation, the sheriff's office determined that the story was ultimately fabricated. So we asked Officer Taylor if he believes that could be the case in this incident.
I've done a lot of investigations involving children, and I like to think that I have a pretty good judgment, can judge these kids, because, you know, obviously some do fabricate the story. In this case itself, I don't believe it's fabricated based on their demeanor and, you know, just talking with them. I think it was a random act. And like I said, we're treating it as an attempted kidnapping, but we don't know until if we locate the suspect, know what his intentions were. I mean, there's a lot of things that could possibly be. And, you know, this subject could have thought that they took something from him, or could be something as much as he believed that this was a runaway that he was familiar with, or a family member or some sort. So it could be a mistake, or just we don't know at this point. But we're treating it as, based on the information we have, that this individual's intention was to kidnap one of these females, if not both.
Again, the vehicle is described as a brown and or tan colored older truck with an extended cab. The make and model are unknown at this time. The suspect is described as a white male adult, believed to be in his mid to late 60s, with shoulder-length gray hair. He was last seen wearing a green-colored shirt and brown or tan cargo pants. Anyone with information regarding this incident is asked to contact the Fortuna Police Department at 707-725-7550. Southern Humboldt's annual fire readiness training took place on June 9th and united firefighters and cultural practitioners. KMUD's Serenity Wood reports.
On Sunday, June 9th, 137 firefighters completed a historic Southern Humboldt fire readiness training at Garberville's Community Park. The RT-130 Skill Building Day was named the Lachindet Incident to honor the Wailaki word for hazel because trainees worked to expand the hand line around a cultural burn site at a hazel grove. Lachindet is a significant plant to Wailaki basket weavers in the use of cultural fire, or enshong konk. These efforts to improve the Lachindet habitat by this large group of local fire trainees represents the continuance of the cultural burning movement in Southern Humboldt that began in 2022 with the first Good Fire conference at the Mateel. Sunday's activities also marked the completion of the National Wildfire Coordinating Group certification of new Type 2 firefighters from the Southern Humboldt Fire Academy, and doubled as a rigorous annual skills and safety refresher for all fire service members. I spoke with Incident Commander Diana Totten, who juggled my questions while responding to requests over her fire radio.
My name is Diana Totten, and I've been involved in the fire service in Southern Humboldt for quite a few years. Today, we're at the community park here, Tubi Park, doing what's called an RT-130, or basically a firefighter readiness training. And we have a lot of departments from all over Southern Humboldt, over 13 fire departments represented here. And we also have representatives and
planning and line group
from
planning. Go ahead.
Quite a few agencies, including the Forest Service, BLM, and CAL FIRE, and the Humboldt Prescribed Burn Association.
Totten explained further, quote, "Each firefighter goes through a series of training scenarios, including hose lays off of engines, handline construction, fire shelters, incidents within incidents, and taking care of all of the equipment that we use every day in the fire service. It is very organized and happens nationwide. This training is a requirement if we're going to work on fires outside of our district," end quote. She went on.
So we have a really strong group of cultural fire practitioners that have come. They've come from two different directions, actually. We have folks from Round Valley as well as Hoopaw, and then some of our local cultural practitioners.
IWI patients made it to the road.
Totten has been involved in the Wildland Fire Service for decades and has worked in many positions on hundreds of fires. She also has Wintu heritage from Hayfork and is Southern Humboldt's own cultural fire advisor through the Humboldt County Prescribed Burn Association. Last June, here at the Southern Humboldt Community Park, Totten taught a new, nationally certified S-190 beginning firefighting course geared specifically towards Indigenous youth, titled Cultural Fire Behavior Training. Over the past few years, when we have been lucky enough to avoid megafires, she has used her spare time to help cultivate prescribed burning practices in our region that also benefit Native youth, working with nonprofits like the Wailaki Cultural Fire Crew and Native Health and Native Hands. Totten sees this year's fire readiness training as an emblem of, quote, "the benefits of working together towards the same goal and speaking the same language," unquote. Tribal members from the north and south ends of Humboldt County were in attendance, some graduating for the first time, others refreshing their certifications from last year. Some, including Ernest Lincoln of Native Health and Native Hands, wore yellow Nomex jackets inscribed with the red letters Nekut Konk In Shong, a Wailaki phrase meaning good fire on the ground. Totten noted major shifts in how agencies are reacting to cultural fire.
The Forest Service, BLM, CAL FIRE all recognize now that the cultural burning or prescribed fire is going to be what's going to save us all. CAL FIRE actually has an insurance policy that they offer to cultural burn practitioners. For instance, last year on the cultural burn that we call the Hazel Grove over here in the community park, we were covered by a $2 million liability insurance through the state in order to accomplish our goals. And that's been a really big hurdle.
Indigenous Fire successfully returned to Southern Humboldt for the first time in almost two centuries last year on October 19th. Sunday's handline construction module, defined as a line scraped or dug to dirt to impede the spread of fire, took place around the perimeter of the community park's Hazel Grove, expanding the existing fire line which was put in place by October's cultural burn. Totten reminded me of today's incident name, Legendet, a word in Wailaki that means hazel. She mused.
Hazel wants fire in its life. And when we put fire to the Hazel Grove, we call it over there, the shoots that come up the next year are straight and really supple, really able to be used for the basketry. With the villages that were here on this flat, you can guarantee they use those hazels.
She gestured behind a row of ancient pepperwoods towards the Wailaki village site known as Kenteste Tongati. Totten stated, quote, "The native people burned the land around here to create habitat for animals, enhance food sources, and reduce the fuel load," unquote. She continued,
"One of the best suppression tools we have, one of the most effective suppression tools we have, is using fire against fire. Using fire against fire. That is a cultural thing. And something else to remember is the native people didn't run around and just light everything on fire. They actually had a plan, and they had specific people that would do it."
Prescribed and cultural fire aren't synonymous, according to seasoned firefighter and Wailaki cultural fire crew member Natasha Carrico. She stated, quote, "We are using cultural fire as a tool to farm the land, regenerate growth, and mitigate invasive species. We're creating fertilization from the ash that changes the DNA structure at a cellular level of our cultural use plants so that they are more productive for us next year," unquote. She went on,
"The object behind cultural fire is when we leave and it regrows, you shouldn't even be able to really tell, besides seeing more native species growing, that we were even there. That's the whole idea behind it. With this way of using fire as a tool in our forest, we didn't have mega fires. Mega fires are only a recent thing. And it's due to the lack of using fire as a tool. So it's pretty cool at a government level. They're now saying, we were wrong, you guys are right, let's start using it more. So that's why me and Perry are able to start doing this kind of stuff again. So it's pretty exciting. And to have you guys to be a part of it and be a part of an actual burn unit that will burn this fall, that everybody is invited to participate in. You don't have to be native to do a cultural burn. Our ancestors understood this balance in nature. You burnt, right? We would burn the grasses, and we knew that there was a seed bank under there. The fire was actually popping a 50-year-old seed bank, and we would get these native grasses to regrow in abundance next year, which was food for us, food for the wildlife. It made the ease of access for the elk to move through, which is also our food too, which brings our water table and keeps our water table up because we're keeping those conifers in check. There's this huge effect when you do fire in a correct way, and you can see it really fast by the next grow season."
Founding director of Native Health and Native Hands, Perry Lincoln, helped oversee the handline construction module. Watching the crews use their shovels to scrape the dirt down to bare mineral soil in a protective circle around the Hazel Grove, he explained,
"Pruning and burning, we manage the forest like our garden."
By the end of a dynamic and rigorous training day, over 130 firefighters were better prepared to help protect our communities for the upcoming fire season. Their smiles and sweat were evidence of the camaraderie of the fire service. In the shade of the park's grand oaks, as the tired firefighters ate their sandwiches, signed paperwork, and chatted about the day's gains, Perry Lincoln thanked the attendees.
Nanulat means thank you in our language. One thing I want to say is that it wasn't that long ago I was holding my grandson on my knee And here he is, his first training. He's, there he is right there. I don't mean to embarrass him or anything, but I'm so proud of all of you helping and all of you that care for the land so much. That's why we're all out here. You know, we want to make good things happen, so thank you.
For KMUD, I'm Serenity Wood.
Local author Ray Raphael and the Friends of the Garberville Library will be hosting an event at 2B Park on Thursday, June 13th, to celebrate the author and his new book, A Life in History. For more information, we spoke with Joanne Wilson.
I am the bridge coordinator for the Garberville Library, and tomorrow night, Thursday night, June 13th, we're having a book signing with Ray Raphael. He is sharing his brand new book, A Life in History. It's a kind of an autobiography, but with a lot of historical context to show what influenced him and to make him into the person he is today.
Ray Raphael was born in 1943 in New York City and moved west after graduating high school. He was active in the 1960s during the Civil Rights Movement and spent two summers in the South working with community organizations in the North. In the 1970s, he started a homestead with his wife near the Humboldt-Mendocino border, raising their two sons. He taught at Whale Gulch School while writing about local history and contemporary issues. Raphael's first book, An Everyday History of Somewhere, used oral histories. In the early 1990s, supported by a National Endowment for the Humanities, Raphael researched the history of common people during the American Revolution. Ray Raphael has written nearly two dozen books, and his latest is an autobiography of sorts. For more, we spoke with the critically acclaimed author.
My name is Ray Raphael, and I moved to Whale Gulch in around 1970, a long time ago. And shortly after moving there, I started asking around to find out from the old timers, like what's been going on around here. And so I talked to a lot of old timers, and it all wound up with my first book, An Everyday History of Somewhere. Well, fast forward to now, over 50 years later, and I'm an old timer. So I'm 81 years old, and I figured, well, maybe it's time that I interview myself.
Prior to publishing his autobiography, Raphael published a book detailing the life of Bob McKee, a local pillar of the Back to the Land movement. In total, Raphael has written 23 books, 11 of which document the American Revolution. But he says,
much of my work is focused on the experiences of individuals within their historical context, and that includes my work on the American Revolution. I highlighted the experiences of everyday people, and I'm an everyday person, as we all are. And so I'm looking at my life, but not necessarily all the personal things, my psychological development and that kind of stuff and relationships, but more my life intersection with history, like how I intersect with historical movements. Like, for instance, I went south for a couple of summers in the civil rights days in the early 60s and was very active in that. And then, of course, the Back to the Land movement here, as we all know, that we're all a part of. And then my work as a historian of the American Revolution, I'm looking at the experiences of individuals in historical context. So that's what my life, it's called A Life in History. And I'm looking at that, the forces that shaped my life, and in turn, how I helped shape history in terms of what I do.
Tomorrow's event starts at 5 p.m. near the 2B Park Playground, where Raphael will be sharing more about his life and how history has shaped it.
It's going to be interactive. I'll introduce the book a little bit and tell a couple of stories. I will tell a couple of stories that are in the book and a couple of stories that aren't in the book. So, and then I want to actually engage folks with the process of looking at our lives in historical context. And so Lord only knows where that's going to lead. We're going to have a amplification and microphones so people can come up and talk, and we can do some interchange, and we'll have a kind of a community chat. How history affects us and how we affect history.
His new book, A Life in History, will be available at the event, where you can get a signed copy from the author.
My publisher has reprinted the Everyday History of Somewhere, so that's back in print, and she also did the Bob McKee book. So those will all be available, and I'll introduce the book and talk. If you come, you will get to see the book, which is actually just marvelous, and you will see Marie's excellent photo art on the front and back cover. It is actually a beautiful book.
You can find copies of his latest book and other works at the Blue Moon Gift Shop in Garberville, in Whitethorn at the Whitethorn Construction Gallery, and in Northern Humboldt at Eureka Books and Northtown Books. In closing, the Garberville Library Manager invites all interested to attend tomorrow's event.
It starts at 5 o'clock, and we will have some very small snacks and things there, and we'll have some seating, but if you prefer, please bring your own chair, and it will be on the playground side of Tubi Park in the shade. So it should be a great event, and we're looking forward to it. It is a free event. You know, a lot of people in this area know Ray because he's been around here for so long. So we're hoping that we get some of the younger people, too, who are not as aware of his wonderful writing style and his terrific books. So, you know, everyone is welcome, and we think it'll be a wonderful evening.
For more information on tomorrow's event and other events and programs, you can visit Friends of the Garberville Library on social media. Turning to Mendocino, KMUD's Matt LaFevre brings the latest headlines from Mendocino County, where a Willits man was booked for attempted murder, fire restrictions went into effect on public land, and summer reading challenges are in full swing.
This is Matt LaFevre with the headlines out of Mendocino County for Wednesday, June 12th, 2024. Let's begin with a troubling incident that occurred on June 6th in Willits. At 11:10 p.m. that day, the Willits Police Department responded to reports of a hit-and-run collision involving a vehicle and a pedestrian in the 100 block of Holly Street. Upon arrival, officers found a group of juveniles providing aid to an unconscious 16-year-old male lying in the middle of the roadway. The victim, though breathing, had sustained critical injuries. Officers immediately began administering medical aid until the Little Lake Fire Department and MedStar Emergency Services arrived on the scene. Witnesses reported that a full-size pickup truck had intentionally struck the juvenile and then fled. During the investigation, Luis Morales, a Willits resident, approached officers and identified himself as the driver. Morales provided the location of the vehicle involved. After gathering statements from Morales and other witnesses, as well as reviewing security footage and collecting physical evidence, officers arrested Morales. He was booked at the Mendocino County Jail on several charges, including attempted murder, assault with a deadly weapon, child endangerment resulting in great bodily injury, causing great bodily injury, and hit and run with injuries. The victim was initially treated at local Howard Memorial Hospital before being flown to an out-of-area hospital for further treatment. The latest reports indicate that he is in stable condition. The investigation into the incident is ongoing, and the police are asking anyone who may have witnessed the event and has not yet come forward to contact Officer Pearson or Officer Angel at 707-459-6122. Now let's turn to an important update regarding fire safety in Mendocino County and other areas across California. As of today, the Bureau of Land Management has issued seasonal fire restrictions for public lands managed by the Ukiah Field Office and the Motherlode Field Office. This decision comes in response to increasingly dry conditions and heightened wildfire danger. These restrictions are part of the year-round statewide fire prevention order and will remain in effect until further notice. The BLM-managed public lands impacted by these restrictions span multiple counties, including Mendocino. Joining these restrictions are Amador, Calaveras, Colusa, El Dorado, Glen, Lake, Marin, Mariposa, Napa, Nevada, Placer, Sacramento, Solano, Sonoma, Stanislaus, Tuolumne, Yolo, and Yuba counties. Central California District Fire Management Officer David Brinsfield emphasizes the necessity of these restrictions, saying, quote, "As temperatures rise, dry conditions escalate in these districts. We ask visitors to adhere to these restrictions to help minimize fire risks on public lands," unquote. Human activity is the leading cause of wildfires in California, responsible for 95% of all wildfires. These often occur near roadways, communities, and recreational areas, posing significant threats to public safety. Taking individual responsibility to reduce wildfire risk is crucial for protecting property, the public, and firefighters. The following restrictions are now in effect. There are no campfires, briquette, charcoal barbecues, or stove fires outside of agency-provided fire rings. There is no smoking except within an enclosed vehicle or building. There is no welding or using torches with an open flame. There are no motorized vehicles or tools powered by internal combustion engines off designated roads or trails. And there is no target shooting, as hot bullet fragments can spark wildfires. Hunting is permitted with a valid California hunting license, but the use of steel-jacketed, steel core, or incendiary ammunition is prohibited. Violating a fire prevention order can result in fines up to $100,000 and/or imprisonment for up to 12 months. Restitution for fire suppression and damage costs may also be imposed on offenders. Now let's turn to the Mendocino County Library, which is celebrating a summer of learning with their summer reading program called Read, Renew, Repeat. Melissa Hannum, the Mendocino County Librarian, said, quote, "Our library branches are celebrating the cycle of reading by offering books to build personal libraries at many of their events, both at the library and in the community," unquote. Studies show that having a personal collection of books supports literacy development in children and teens. This program offers more than just books. There are professional entertainers and activities focusing on science, technology, engineering, and math. Additionally, the library is going to provide free lunches during the Lunch at the Library program, funded by the California Summer Meal Coalition and the California Library Association. The library has partnered with local organizations to offer free lunches and activities to youth 18 and under. From June 25th to August 9th, the Coast Community Branch Library will provide balanced, nutritious meals each Tuesday through Friday at noon, thanks to ongoing partnerships with the Point Arena School District. There are plenty of literacy activities in store for Mendocino County Library patrons this summer. For more info, visit mendolibrary.org or contact the Mendocino County Library at 707-234-2873. And that's the latest from Mendocino County. I'm Matt LaFever in Hopland, reporting for KMUD News.
In state news, California makes progress towards conserving 30% of land and water. Suzanne Potter reports.
The public comment period is now open on California's new framework for deciding which managed areas within coastal waters meet the definition of conserved and where protection improvements need to be made. California's goal is to preserve 30% of state lands and waters by the year 2030. The Ocean Protection Council released science-based guidelines this week on what counts as conserved. Joss Hill is project director at the Pew Charitable Trusts.
An area is considered a conservation area if the lands and coastal waters are durably protected and managed to sustain functional ecosystems, both intact and restored, and the diversity of life that they support.
People can weigh in on the process at a series of upcoming workshops in Arcata, Monterey, and San Diego. The Ocean Protection Council will also hold two webinars this summer and will accept feedback by email. Hill says the new framework will be used by the state to evaluate protections in marine managed areas. The state's 30 by 30 policy sets goals to improve biodiversity, public access, and climate resilience.
The stakes of failing to protect nature are high. And the loss of biodiversity undermines the ability of ecosystems to function and support a healthy environment. And this is particularly important in a changing climate, in which loss of biodiversity reduces nature's resilience to change.
The evaluation criteria will be finalized in the fall, and the preliminary decision on which places qualify as conservation areas will be presented in December. Support for this reporting was provided by the Pew Charitable Trusts. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thank you for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Larry Lashley. And thanks to our reporters, Serenity Wood, Matt LaFever, and Suzanne Potter. Reporting from our studio in Redway, I'm Lauren Schmidt.